The path of inquiry by Arthur Osborne. Self-inquiry is not analysis. It has nothing in common with philosophy or psychology. The Maharishi showed this when he declared that no answer the mind gives can be right. And indeed, in this, it resembles a Zen koan. If it had a mental answer, it would be a philosophical conundrum, not a spiritual practice. And it was as a spiritual practice that the Maharishi prescribed it. So, anyone who tells you what the answer to the inquiry is shows by the very fact that he has not understood it. It does not mean arguing or saying that I am not this or not that. It means concentrating on the pure sense of being, the pure I am-ness of me. And this, one discovers, is the same as pure consciousness, pure formless awareness. So far is it from being a mental practice that the Maharishi told us not to concentrate on the head while doing it, but on the heart. By this, he did not mean the physical heart at the left side of the chest, but the spiritual heart on the right. This is not a physical organ and also not a yogic or tantric chakra, but it is the center of our sense of being. The Maharishi told us so, and those who have followed his instructions in meditation have found it to be so. The ancient Hebrews knew of it. The wise man's heart is at his right hand, but a fool's heart is at his left. It says in the Bible. It is referred to also in that ancient Advaitic scripture, the Yoga Vasishta, in verses which the Maharishi quoted as numbers 22 to 27 in his supplementary 40 verses on reality. Concentration on the heart does not mean thinking about the heart, but being aware in and with the heart. After a little practice, it sets up a current of awareness that can actually be felt physically, though far more than physical. At first, this is felt in the heart, sometimes in the heart and head, and connecting them. Later, it pervades and transcends the body. Perhaps it could be said that this current of awareness is the answer to the question, who am I? Since it is the wordless experience of I-ness. There should be regular times for this meditation, since the mind accustoms itself and responds more readily. I have put the word meditation in inverted single quotes, since it is not meditation in the usual sense of the word, but only concentration on self or on being. As Bhagavan explained, meditation requires an object to meditate on, whereas in self-inquiry, there is only the subject and no object. Good times are first thing when you wake up in the morning and last thing before you go to sleep at night. At first, a good deal of time and effort may be needed before the current of awareness is felt. Later, it begins to arise more and more easily. It also begins to occur spontaneously during the day when one is not meditating. That explains Bhagavan's saying that one should keep up the inquiry constantly, not only during meditation. It comes to be more and more constant, and when lost or forgotten, to need less and less reawakening. A man has three modes of manifestation: being, thinking, and doing. Being is the most fundamental of the three because He can't think or do unless he first is, but it is so covered over by the other two that it is seldom experienced. It could be compared to the cinema screen, which is the support for the pictures without which they could not be seen, but which is so covered over with them that it is not ordinarily noticed. Only very occasionally, for a brief glimpse, does the spiritually untrained person experience the sheer fact of being, and when he does, he recalls it afterwards as having been a moment of pure happiness, pure acceptance, pure rightness. Self-inquiry is the direct approach to conscious being, and therefore it is necessary to suspend thinking and doing while practicing it. It may lead to a state when conscious, instead of the previous unconscious being, underlies thinking and doing, but at first they would interrupt it, so they have to be held off. This is the path. The doctrine on which it is based is Advaita, non-duality, which might be rendered identity or no otherness. Its scripture for the Maharishi's followers is his 40 verses on reality, together with the supplementary 40 verses which he later added. In this, he declares all religions postulate the three fundamentals, the world, the individual, and God. Not all in a formal way, for there are also non-theistic religions, but essentially this is what we start from. Whether I am educated or uneducated, my own existence is the basis from which I start, the direct awareness to which everything else is added. Then, outside myself, my mind and senses report a world of chairs and tables and trees and sky and other people in it. Mystics tell me that all this is illusion, and nowadays nuclear scientists agree with them. They say that the red book I am holding is just a cluster of electrons whirling about at high speed, that its redness is just the way my optic apparatus interprets a vibration of a certain wavelength, and similarly with its other qualities. But anyway, that is how it presents itself to my perception. I also have a feeling of some vastness, some power, some changeless reality behind the vulnerability of the individual and the mutability of the world. It is about this third factor that people disagree, some holding that it is the real self of the individual, others that it is a being quite other than him, and others again that it does not exist at all. The verse continues, but it is only the one reality that manifests as these three. This implies that self-inquiry is the quest for the one reality underlying the apparent trinity of individual, world, and God. But the mistake inherent in dualism does not consist in supposing that God is a separate being from you, but in supposing that you are a separate being from God. It is not belief in God that is wrong, but belief in the ego. Therefore, the verse continues, one can say the three are really three only so long as the ego lasts. Then the verse turns to the practical conclusion, as Bhagavan always did in his teaching. Therefore, to abide in one's own being, where the I or ego is dead, is the perfect state. And that is what one is trying to do by self-inquiry, to abide as the self, the pure being, that one essentially is casting aside the illusory reality of the ego, feeling one's insignificance before that mighty power. One may worship it in one of its manifestations as Krishna, see, or Christ or Rama, but under whatever name and form one may worship the absolute reality, it is only a means for realizing it without name and form. That means appreciating its infinity, realizing that it alone is and leaves no room for a separate me subsisting apart from it. Therefore, the verse continues, that alone is true realization wherein one knows oneself in relation to that reality, attains peace and realizes one's identity with it. And this is done by self-inquiry. If the first person, I, exists, then the second and third persons, you and he, also exist. By inquiring into the nature of the I perishes. With it, you and he also perish. However, that does not mean blank annihilation. It only means annihilation of the illusion of separate identity. That is to say, of the ego, which is the source of all suffering and frustration. Therefore, the verse continues, the resultant state which shines as absolute being is one's own natural state, the self. Not only is this not a gloomy or dismal state or anything to be afraid of, but it is the most radiant happiness, the most perfect bliss. For him who is immersed in the bliss of self-realization arising from the extinction of the ego, what more is there to achieve? He does not see anything as being other than the self. Who can apprehend this state? Note that in speaking of the unutterable bliss of self-realization, Bhagavan says that it is achieved through the extinction of the ego, that is, the apparent individual identity. So that, although nothing is lost, something does have to be offered in sacrifice. And while being offered, it appears a terrible loss, the supreme loss, one's very life. Only after it has been sacrificed does one discover that it was nothing and that all has been gained, not lost. This means that understanding alone cannot constitute the path. Whatever path may be followed in whatever religion, the battle must be fought and the sacrifice made. Without that, a man can go on all his life proclaiming that there is no ego and yet remain as much a slave to the ego as ever. Although the 40 verses on reality is a scripture of the path of knowledge, Bhagavan asks in it, if since you are a single being, you cannot see yourself, how can you see God? And he goes on to answer, only by being devoured by him. This brings the path of inquiry to the same point as the path of surrender, since in either case, the ego must be sacrificed. It is a very profound verse. It recalls the Hebrew saying, no man can see God and live. Many people see visions of God in one form or another, but that is not seeing God. The mind and senses of a man knot themselves together into what wrongly supposes itself to be an individual entity separate from the universal being which it aspires to see. But that universal being is the true self of it. Only by surrendering their illusory individual entity to be devoured out of existence Can the mind and senses become true instruments for perception by what is thereafter understood to be their true self, so that, as the Maharishi sometimes said, the only way to see God is to be God. So is to from Mountain Path, Volume 2, 1968.